Happy Easter.
Right, we go over.
Okay, explain, please.
That was Second Chapter of X. The band called Second Chapter of X. And they,
Hey, get your hand away.
We're sharing a microphone today.
Because we have more guests than we know how to do it.
Yeah. I thought about, you know, because it's my turn this week, and because the guest that we thought was going to bring cassettes.
I am so sorry. but I'm no longer sorry now that I've heard that. That could never have brought anything so glorious
as the
second chapter of Acts.
I was going to play something evil and satanic and noisy. But I do that most of the weeks that it's my turn.
Yes.
And so that is one of two cassettes that I still own from a long, 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 long time ago. My older brother, when I was 9, started hanging around with a bunch of Assembly of God kids. This is 1974.
Wow.
And he came home with this record. Like, he got born again, and he came home with this record by Second Chapter of Acts. And it's the grooviest Christian rock of all time.
It's awesome. Like, I kind of love it.
They harmonized so perfectly, and they were like brothers and sisters. Mm. Like, they were a brother and two sisters, or a brother and a sister, and their friend.
Like the Danielson family?
Kind of like the Danielson family, who I also love. They were great. They had no idea that they were helping to jumpstart a musical genre that would become completely artless and corrupt within the next two decades.
Right.
You know,
amen.
Because there's no one. I mean, seriously, I hear some of the new Christian music that exists out there just because I know some folks, you know, who still listen to it regularly by choice.
And my first apartment in Dallas, for some reason, the cable that we had set up in our building, when you would turn the TV on, it would always default to, like, I think it was called ZTV or something. and it was Christian MTV, basically.
Yeah.
And I would watch fascinated for like 20, 30 minutes at a time, but as much as I could stomach. But it was always fascinating to see, like, oh, okay, so you're supposed to be the Christian Wilson Phillips.
Right.
And you're supposed to be the Christian Pet Shop Boys. Like, it was like clearly it was the off-brand version of everything. It was the Hunt's catch-up of Christian rock.
But Second Chapter of Acts were on brand. Like, they were their own awesome thing.
Now, I would totally listen to that. I would have that going in my car all the time and be so happy all of the time.
Yeah.
Thrilled.
They're like soft rock kids who just decided that they loved Jesus. You know, they didn't come at it from, well, we love Jesus and we want to sound contemporary.
Right. So there was no marketing involved.
We're
going to
do something. Like, they were just like, we're just, this is us. Yeah. They were amazing.
It's so good and pure, it makes my skin hurt.
And we should probably introduce our guests since they have been chiming in already. Bless them. Praise him.
Blessings.
I'm an atheist, but I love Godspell, and I've been annoying Dave with it all day. It's been great. Anyway, joining us today, of course, dear, dear friend of the show and one of our great inspirations and closest friends, Miss Gray Drake from Movies.com and the Popcorn Mafia podcast. And also joining us today, I'm so thrilled. I'm a huge fan. He is the host of the on hiatus, but hopefully returning soon, podcast,
sure,
Glitter in the Garbage. He's a quintuple threat.
What?
He's a director. He's got his show. He was the first director of the show Jersey Shoresicle.
Yes,
which is just having one life after another, and is no doubt coming to a town near you. Mm-hmm. He teaches at the Groundlings. He every time I turn on the TV, it seems half the time he's popping up in random crazy sitcoms. Mm-hmm. He is a YouTube sensation with Tanya Roberts for Tahiti Village and Fagney and Gacy, and of course the Chloe videos that have set the internet on fire. And somehow He is on our show, and we're so thrilled to have him. Please welcome Drew Droege.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
You're an internet arsonist.
I love it. Set it ablaze. Make it happen.
You actually have inspired me to forever refer to the holiday as Halloween.
So that's actually one that I've always, usually when I do the videos, like we write the videos, and then the last thing we decide is, how is Chloe going to pronounce the title of each one?
Toast,
and exactly, and all the different, and whatever. And but the Halloween one is one I've always thought was because there's always that apostrophe between the two E's, and it's always made me laugh. And I'm like, what human being out there pronounces it that way other than Chloe?
None.
Godspell is like a really long episode of Zoom.
That is brilliant.
It's that aesthetic of that era.
Such crap.
It creeps me out so much. Like adults and those, and we were talking earlier about clown theater. Yeah. Like just,
no, look, I don't like hippies, and I don't. Jesus holds a very marginal place in my life. All these things that I normally wouldn't care about, all brought together somehow, it becomes this magical thing. I think it's really the songs. Like, I think if you took that cast and put them in tuxedos and evening gowns, and they just sang those songs, I'd be perfectly happy. Mm. Sure. I don't need the clowns and the miming and the whatever else.
Well, now I kind of want you to have a release your own record in which the title track is Jesus Holds a Very Marginal Place in My Life.
I want any song with the word marginal in it. I'm way into it. That sounds like rock and roll. Like I've never heard
a lot of hand claps.
But between songs, it's like there's someone with a slide whistle.
Yes,
the whole time, and a barn.
No, I really should. Normally, I just fast forward from song to song, but once a year, I do the whole thing.
Oh yeah, but I love Jesus. I don't love a lot of the people around Jesus, but I hate Godspell. But I love Jesus Christ Superstar. That will get me going anytime.
That's a good one too.
Yeah.
I just like Second Chapter of Acts.
Is it Acts?
Acts like the Bible?
It's A-C-T-S.
Got it.
The Book like of Genesis. Acts. The
sure,
New Testament.
Of course. I'm a heathen. Yeah. I don't. You have to explain these things.
Acts came after Leviticus, right? In the Old Testament?
I believe. It's in the New Testament.
It's in the New Testament. It's after the Gospels.
What happens in the second chapter of the Book of Acts is that the Holy Spirit comes down to all of Jesus' followers, and then they get Holy Spirited.
Hand claps.
That makes that right.
And also fittingly for Easter, Gray's hair is colored by the good people at PAS.
That's so true. So true.
I love that they're good people.
I've been enjoying getting people's response. Like they say I'm from the Capitol. Now that the Hunger Games is a thing, every single person I run into, they're like, "Oh, from the Capitol." Eh? Wow. It's like, yeah, I read the book too. Thanks.
Wow.
Yes, I am. I just got, next is cat whiskers coming out of my face. Thanks.
Or a hat made from a shoe.
Right. Done already.
Just tell them you're from the Apple and tell them to go look it
up.
Oh,
right, and if they don't know what the Apple is, they're terrible people.
Yeah, like, look it up.
Because that's the first thing I thought when I saw Hunger Games is all these people are from the Apple.
I had the exact same thought. Yeah. The whole thing, it felt exactly like.
Like beard glitter. Is all there is.
Where are the BIM marks?
Oh, we need to bring that back.
I recently saw the trailer for that in a compilation of trailers, like at the New Beverly.
Uh-huh.
And my boyfriend goes, he looks at me just with horror on his face and goes, what is that from?
Oh, he doesn't know it.
He didn't know it.
They're showing the new art again in the next couple months.
And I was like, I can't believe you've been inside me because.
Now, were you guys at the first new art screening years ago at the Apple?
I think you were. On Valentine's
Day? I saw you there.
Yes.
Oh.
And
my world was never the same.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I was like, how have I never seen this?
Dave Cobb and I looked at each other like, how did we miss this? Like,
right.
How was this not on our radar?
Yeah. Right. I know. It was an experience.
Well, what was so wonderful about that particular night was we got home and it's like 3:00 in the morning, which is not my bedtime.
Yeah.
At all.
That's like 6 hours past.
And I get on IMDb just to investigate more about it, because one thing I love about movies like that is that there's this air of mystery to them, like, how did this even get made? Like, who thought this was good? As they went along and they were watching bits and pieces of the movie each day, who sat there and thought, we're doing great, you know? And And so I looked it up on IMDb, and it said, we'll be on Showtime at 4:30 this morning. And no. I was like, ooh, and I had him like get it in the TiVo real fast, and then we had it in TiVo for the next 2 years.
Yep.
Wow.
And every time people would come over, we'd be like, we have got something to show you.
Right.
And, yeah.
Before it was on DVD.
And it wasn't even Letterboxd. It was still Pan and Scan, but it was still awesome.
Oh, yeah. It was on like Stars or something. I remember watching people had bootleg copies of it because somehow it was able to be on, they leaked it on that. But yeah, it, if you haven't seen it.
And it's on, you're a it's now person. On, it's now on Netflix Instant. So
it, there's oh no my God, excuse. You're right.
So yeah, Steve has no excuse.
He doesn't now.
You have to watch
this. And it's a Bible story, so go home.
It is a Bible story. It is.
It's
right.
Easter. Alfie and Bebe are Easter for Steve. Adam and Eve.
Yes.
And he, his heathen self. He definitely needs it.
There's actually, you know, it's cut from the film, but there's a bit of it in the trailer, and it's on the soundtrack. There's an opening number called Creation.
Ooh.
I've heard that, and it's on the sound. I have a bootleg soundtrack. I don't have the actual.
Because you know, well, because you know, Mr. Tops, who shows up at the end for no reason, he's at the beginning of the movie. Like okay. That, there's actually he's supposed to kind of bookend the story. Okay. So completely random when he turns up in the last act for
The whole movie would have made complete sense.
Oh well, yeah,
there'd been that number in it.
But I mean, it's a literal Deus Ex Machina, you know.
They took it out because it made too much sense.
I just love the story of when it was at, was it Cannes, I believe? They handed out records of the soundtrack, and the audience hated it so much that they threw the records into it, and it sliced to the screen, the movie screen, because people were
The version I heard of that was that it was at the El Capitan on opening week.
Okay.
But I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like I'd rather it be in France.
They could all be apocryphal.
It seems like I always imagine like French people getting angry and throwing things at the screen like baguettes and brie.
They're that emphatic about their art.
Right.
And I support that completely.
This latest good art piece of shit. Man, man. They throw that.
Clean screen. Podcast. Great.
Sorry. I made it, 7 minutes?
We'll bleep you
out. So.
We were having so much fun, we have to talk about.
American Reunion. American
boy.
Now, the rest of us had to see it for our actual jobs, and poor Drew took a bullet.
you darling so, man.
You know, I was just telling.
Did you at least buy a ticket to something else and then walk in?
Oh, I should have. I should have done that. No, you know what? I probably would have gone to see
back
it.
Up a tap.
Okay, sure. I probably would have gone to see it anyway because I've seen the other three in the theater. And it's like one of those things, I have a thing about completion that I have to go and see it. So I didn't want to, but I did. I sat through it. I feel like the whole thing was really bizarre and like a social experiment more than entertainment. I was just sort of like, who is this movie for?
Exactly.
I don't understand like who was enjoying this. You know, it's like there's nothing about it that's teenager. There's nothing about it that is like appropriate to anyone in their 30s, which are these characters are all supposed to be in their early 30s. It's like these things that were so awkward when you're 18 are no longer awkward when you're in your 30s, right. Unless you're a complete infant.
And I also, I mean, just starting at the very, very beginning, like this is supposed to be these kids' like 10-year reunion, right? But they fully acknowledge it's 13 years later.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Like, I don't understand the math, off.
I also think, too, there's this belief in the movie that we have been following these characters and we've been caring about them so much
right.
that we would constantly. All call them to task because we remember this class graduated in 1999. Like, and we really care about Kevin and Vicky and what they've been up to. And like, they sort of have this, it's this like Harry Potter Hunger Games belief that like you've really been, you know, they're fans that are going to dress like Shannon Elizabeth at the premiere. You know what I mean? Like they almost have that feeling.
As you'll recall, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oz is doing blah, blah, blah.
Because
yeah,
if they had just said 10-year reunion, I mean, you would have just bought it. I mean, like, fine that it came out a few years later. But for them to say, we kind of missed it by a couple years. It's the 13th reunion.
That just is the very beginning of, like, how sloppy and disgusting
it
is.
Yeah, we're not nitpicking. There's just a mountain of nits to be picked. So.
Oh, God, it's just one
it's
big
so
nit.
Lazy. The whole thing was and flabby and, like, just sort of like tired. There was so many performances in it and writing in it that it was like, first of all, it's 2 full hours long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I was like, I couldn't believe how long it was. And you know,
and they still skip like a ton of the characters. Like Natasha Lyonne shows up in the last
the women,
5 minutes.
The women are barely existent.
I had to go to the bathroom so badly, and I was like, and they haven't even wrapped up the Jim and Michelle, and you obviously know who those people are. That's the Jim and Michelle storyline. So I was like, I had to go to the bathroom. So I was like, I went to the bathroom and came back and missed the entirety of Natasha Lyonne's performance. Oh. I didn't see any of her. And then she was in the final credits, and I was like, I guess Natasha Lyonne was in the movie while I was in the bathroom for 5 minutes.
I heard that there's like a thing after the credits, and I couldn't possibly imagine staying through the credits.
Yeah.
Because during the entire movie, I was sitting next to Alonzo and silently begging him to scratch my eyes out.
I didn't quite understand what that look meant, but no, we would just give it, we just gave each other these looks of like, really?
Oh my God, it was
really? Yeah. Oh. I mean, what I always liked about at least the original American Pie, and to some extent the sequels, was that the idea that like they could be smutty, but that the characters were sweet, and that
girls
could want sex without being dirty, dirty sluts.
Right.
And in this movie, like the women are treated so badly, yes. and like either made the butt of these jokes or are these super blando nothings. I mean, like Mina Savari and Tara Reid have nothing to do in this
joyless.
Movie, except show off some regrettable plastic surgery choices. Uh-huh. But again, I don't even blame them. This is like the Hollywood machine, and what it does. Cause these are women are not. I mean, they're early 30s, right?
And also Allison Hannigan, who is so adorable on How I Met Your Mother, and who I love. They make her look so frumpy in this movie. And it's like,
she looked exhausted.
She looks really tired. And you're like, I know she doesn't look like that. I watch her on TV every week. Like, she's not.
Their one stab at realism was, let's make the mother of the 2-year-old look like she hasn't slept. You know?
Right.
But
everything
else in this movie will exist in this crazy cloud cuckoo land, you know.
Was anybody else surprised that Tara Reid actually looked sort of together?
I was surprised.
I was really rooting for her. She looked great.
I think she did too.
And I was hoping that she would be in the movie because you know what? I unabashedly really adore Tara Reid.
Oh, did you really?
I have zero problems with
and
her.
And she was in Josie and the Pussycats,
which is wonderful.
A great movie.
Yeah.
Josie and the Pussycats is literally a great movie.
I totally agree. I'm not goofing here. I totally agree. I think it is so much fun.
And even when she was on her downward spiral and hosting Paradise on TV, I watched that religiously every week because she was having a party. It was so great just to watch her have a good time.
Yeah.
And every time something horrible would happen to her in the press, like, I don't feel this way about celebrities ever. Like, I don't care what happens to them. But every time something bad would happen to her in the press, I'd be like, poor Tara Reid. Like, why is this happening to Tara Reid? Why is she doing this to herself?
I gotta say, I still feel that way about Lindsay Lohan. I still am holding out hope that she's gonna get it together. And with each passing year, it seems like less of a possibility. But I remember the good times, you know, and just how staggeringly talented she was and still could be. But
you know, I turned on Mean Girls the other day and was shocked at like how wholesome and sweet and talented she was, because I've totally forgotten at this point.
Sure.
And it's like, when I saw her in CNN, the last time she was on Saturday Night Live, you know, I was like, oh, come on, honey, like, get it together. This wasted talent in this city.
Yeah, the only thing that Tara Reid had done was like a bad...
like Restylane filler thing.
No, a bad boob job. Her face is the same.
Well, and she had a weird stomach thing going on for a while. I remember seeing all that stuff. But
she got that all fixed up. She looked great.
And she looks
great.
Movie.
But she just walks around going, hi. You know, like there's nothing going on.
The most acting that she gets to do is just, I can't believe you'd think that about me.
Which is the weirdest, because I literally out loud said, what? In other words, that character makes no sense. Like, that he's not gonna cheat on his wife with you because you guys were high school sweethearts. That's what you gave her to play. Like, that's such a weird position to be in. And it's
boring.
It's boring. I have this is a stupid question. I did not stay through the credits either to see this, but was that Rebecca De Mornay at the end of the movie?
Yes.
She looks amazing.
Pretty good facelift.
She does.
Not bad.
Because she comes on screen and I was like, oh, she's an attractive lady. And then when she started talking, I was like, I think that's Rebecca De Mornay. And then there's a cradle joke in there. And I was like,
and a Risky Business reference.
Of course.
I didn't know it was Rebecca De Mornay.
No, I mean, that was, I didn't.
She looks different now.
She does look a little different, but I mean, when I saw her on screen at first, I was like, she seems familiar, like a long lost summer. And then I remembered.
Yeah. And it's not Jennifer O'Neill.
But yeah, because we got confused after the screening if it which blonde kind of 90s star it was. And then finally somebody said Rebecca De Mornay. I was like, that's why I was so uncomfortable leaving my baby with her.
Yeah. No, it just, but I wish this had been, and I don't know if I had any reason to expect that it would be good on any level, because the first one was really great.
Wonderful.
The first one,
so much fun.
The first one resurrected the teen sex comedy.
Sex comedy, yeah.
And I was really happy that they had done that. And then the second one was, it made me laugh.
Yeah.
The third one was wretchedly bad. I saw it at the drive-in. And then this one is almost as bad as part three. That's why part three is actually still the worst one.
You think? Because I felt like this one was so head-scratchingly
bad. The third one at least had that dance-off in it.
Sean William Scott carries everything in that he, like, if he's in the scene, he carries the whole thing, because he's still behaving like part one.
Right. Yes, and I believe that that guy, Stifler is still that guy at 31, like, whereas the other ones, and right. I really like Jason Biggs. I find him really charming, and I think he's great. And so he, you know, he's doing the best he can with it. And I think, like, Yeah, but there's just so much in it that I don't remember the other movies, and I'm not sensitive to this, but except when it's like four or five jokes, but like, I don't remember the other movies being so homophobic as this one. And this, it was lazy homophobia. It wasn't like mean as much.
Yeah,
as
like there's an early
gay
scene.
Panic.
Yeah, totally. Well, the stuff later with the lacrosse players who were Stifler's buddies, I thought was kind of funny. But like, there's a scene early on where Chris Klein comes home to find his girlfriend Katrina Bowden in the hot tub.
Oh, that was so irritating.
With this beefy black guy, and he thinks that she's cheating on him. But it turns out no, he's their interior decorator, and he's wearing this like yellow thong bikini, and he's like
so lazy,
flexing his buttons up, and it was such a grotesque stereotype. I thought the joke was going to be that no, she really was cheating on him, and that was this idiot's idea of what acting like a gay guy would be. But no,
I thought actual gay. I thought the same thing. I thought, how much more interesting would it be if he were the interior decorator and sleeping with her in a straight, you know, or something other than like the hey girl thing where you're like, really, 2012, like,
well.
And the Ricky Martin thing was so annoying to me because they hit it like five times.
The
sex
life of Ricky Martin.
Yeah, the sex life of Ricky Martin. I'm so embarrassed by that, first of all, that he has to play that. Then it was, you do know that he's gay, right? Like, followed up afterwards. It's like, oh, here is a sledgehammer.
Let's underline
that. Here is my head. Put it on a chopping block and knock me. Like, we get it.
Why didn't I keep pondering this movie. Like, it's made me think more than like Tree of Life, because I can't figure out what they were trying to say.
I agree.
I graduated when they graduated, and so I'm their age, and I can't figure out, like, are they trying to say that they peaked in high school and that life has, even though they're married and they have babies and they have jobs, like, has it never gotten better than that? Or is it that you're not as lame as you think you are? Like, I've suffered from an existential crisis.
Cool, because they don't look like they're ever having fun in the movie.
It's desperate.
You don't understand exactly where the point is, where the joy is.
The thing is that I understand that when you get older, it is fun to take a vacation from your normal life and to get drunk and to go to a lake and to put on a bikini and f*** somebody in a bush. Sorry. Like, I understand
you're
that that's...
You're dirty.
Sorry. I understand
you
that that's...
say dirty swears.
I understand that that's fun. I get that that's a good vacation, especially when you're a parent. Like, your life has changed. But they are not having fun in this movie. So that's the problem. And I shudder to think that I could be anything like these people.
And I will say, one of the highlights is Eugene Levy's stuff is actually
really
pretty good. I mean, he has a fun scene with Stifler. He has a fun scene with Stifler's mom. But then even he and Jennifer Coolidge get this coda at the end of the movie that is so tasteless and not funny. And my thought went to, wow, Christopher Guest hasn't made a movie in a long time. These guys should be busier with better things.
They're incredible, and the two of them are such geniuses. And you know, and you just want them to have more to do. Yeah.
Because that's when the adults were talking.
Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Were on
the
screen. Yeah.
Exactly.
Shh, the grown-ups are talking.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I so want somebody to put Jennifer Coolidge in a movie where she can play Fawn, what's her face? The character she does in Beverly Linwood.
Fern Magnin.
Fern Magnin.
I mean, best. I mean,
I almost threw up. I laughed so hard the first time I saw her do that.
She's wickedly, poisonously funny. I mean, she has an effect on me. Like, when she does anything, I will watch her. And that probably would have been another reason I would have gone to see the movie. I was like, well, Coolidge is in it. Right. And I'm sure it's going to be. I will suffer just to see her do anything. Because she's. You know, and she's also a great actor, and I can't wait for her moment where people realize that and put her in stuff that's not just the bimbo, the floozy.
Right.
But you know, I mean, she created MILF. I mean, that was didn't exist until her. You know, in that movie, so which is pretty crazy and awesome. Yeah.
What's the other movie that's happening?
Damsels in Distress.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Who's seen it?
I saw it. I saw
we've
it.
All seen it.
Yeah,
it.
I did. I saw it yesterday.
Okay, we've all seen it.
Did I read that you ran over a child?
Yesterday, I had to go to the 10:30 screening at the ArcLight yesterday, and so I got up and was crazy late, and almost ran over a child crossing the street to get to the ArcLight so I can get to the movie on time because they won't seat you if you're late. And I did tweet that of like, I almost ran over a child in order to see the new Whit Stillman movie. Hashtag officer, have you heard of Greta Gerwig? It's like, really, why am I this crazy to get to a movie that, you know, yeah. What do you guys think?
I'm a huge Whit Stillman fan of the first films. Like, Metropolitan is still, like, probably one of my favorite movies of all time. You know, that it's a Christmas movie is just a bonus for me. But, you know, like, I enjoyed Barcelona when it came out. I haven't seen it since. I like Last Days of Disco. So I've been waiting for a new Whit Stillman movie for, like, 13 or 14 years. This one felt like it clanged a little. Like there's, he does this sort of tightrope with these characters that speak very stylized dialogue, mm-hmm. and you have to deliver it just so. And I think that while I love Greta Gerwig and other things, and I think she's really talented, and I think she gets a lot of the look and things right for this movie, there's something about the way that she does his dialogue that feels like you're watching an actor recite dialogue.
I completely agree. I find her to be wretched in this movie, and I because it's, there was nothing happening with her, and it's like her. I thought the writing for her especially was so great, and I was so wanting more. I wanted Parker Posey in the 90s to do it.
Or Chloe Sevigny.
Chloe Sevigny would have been great.
She looks like Chloe.
She looks like Chloe.
Right.
Almost as much as you do.
Well, thank you. someone like Juno Temple or someone imagine somebody that like really would have gotten this character. That's because it reminded me a little bit of the As Bees and Honey Drown, like that, one of those sort of characters, like that play with the,
sure, yeah,
the one of those characters which is larger than life, sort of another era, a deeply messed up, troubled person who has created this character. I thought that was fascinating about the movie. But Greta Gerwig made me crazy because what she was doing was this bland, blah, lack of acting, which in itself is so stylized to me. I may as well be watching Joanne Worley, you know, live at the Copacabana Club. Like, it was about as believable to me. Like, I was like, that's not real. Like, that's not, like, I don't believe that you have any connection to who this person is.
I loved this movie for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then for the next hour, I was like, wait a minute, what is this about? Like, can we what? Adam Brody, what? Yeah. Like, really? And so by the time that they're doing the Sambola, I was like, I'm glad nobody showed up. This movie sucks. I'm mad now. And I just loved watching people walk out of the theater.
Ooh, really?
Because I don't really think that my crowd at noon on Friday understood what they were watching. And so I was like the only one laughing in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And
I genuinely laughed at a lot of it, but I agree.
It was, I got tired of this one, and that was weird because I love the costumes. I love that they all looked so weird, kind of Donna Reed and, you know.
What?
Well, you have an interesting take on this.
Well, I don't want to walk on anybody. I want to wait till everyone's done saying what
and
they need scene. To say.
And see.
I have the dissenting opinion.
You're wrong.
I loved this movie. And I loved it kind of for the reasons that you guys disliked it. Mm. I feel like I too thought that Greta Gerwig's character was reciting her lines, but it felt to me like that was who this person was. Like, it felt to me like this is the person who's always thinking three sentences ahead of what she's about to say. Like, she's got an opinion and advice and instructions for everyone, and she's already prepared it in the back of her head. And now it's time for her to deliver it. And she's going to say it like it's the Gettysburg Address. Mm-hmm. Like, that was where I immediately bought her as this person doing this thing and saying these things the way she said them. The other reason I loved it is because it is so messy, because there's 17 different little plots going on that don't really seem to tie together in any way, except when it was over, I thought, oh, wait, everything that they talk about, the suicide center, the fact that this is a self-made clique of superior women, the idiot frat guys, the idea that it would be great to start a dance craze, the idea that you can go around correcting entire groups of people, the cult of dumb failed suicides, of throwing yourself off the second floor of a building. All of them are these sort of cozy, wrongheaded, but still happy in their own way, examples of how ridiculous but still kind of awesome groupthink is. And I feel like each one of these little plot bits are sort of reflective of that. Like, our little group is a bunch of idiot dudes who don't know the names of the colors. And our little group is a bunch of, you know, girls who think they're better than everybody else and who go around trying to fix everybody. And this other little group is nameless failed suicides. And this other group, this other thing that Greta Gerwig is trying to do is institute a dance craze that everybody will want to participate in and feel is great. All of Whit Stillman's movies are about this very, very tiny subset of people, the super moneyed preppy class of people. And he's part of that group personally. Like, his father was the assistant secretary of commerce under JFK.
Wow.
His godfather was E. Digby Baltzell.
Best name ever.
Renowned sociologist who coined the term WASP.
Wow.
And it's Stillman who gave us Urban Haute Bourgeoisie, which I still like to use.
Yes.
So you don't get any preppier than that. And so I think all of his films are sort of like a critique of that culture, but at the same time, it's viewed from the inside, and he loves it so much that he finds great value in it too. And so he wants to make you laugh. You know, he's being satirical about his own people, but at the same time, he thinks it's kind of awesome. And so I feel like, and what has he done for the past 14 years? Nothing.
Zero.
How preppy is that? Having no job at all.
It depends. Awesome. Depends on nothing. How many topsiders he's purchased.
I went to Paris. I went to Paris for 10 years. That's what he did. He went to Paris for a decade.
Of course he did.
And he wrote.
Ugh.
Yeah. And so that is as like emblematic of what he is and of what his films are. And I'm super into them because I said this in my review, but it's kind of like watching a movie about space aliens because I don't know these people,
right,
but I'm fascinated by them. And no matter how weird and twee and strange they are, I'm in because it's not like anything else.
And it's very genuine. I mean, he's genuine and he knows it. And that's where I think that's what I've always liked in his movies. It's like he is definitely setting up his world. And I'd much rather watch one of his movies than a movie where that is of a world that doesn't comment on its... Or doesn't, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'd much rather watch something like this than something like I always forget the name of the movie, Margot at the Wedding, I find disgusting.
Noah Baumbach is totally influenced by it.
Exactly. Because it's like a movie that where it's like, oh, it's not at all weird to you that you're not even making a joke that Robin Hitchcock and Grandmaster Flash are playing at your wedding and your multi-ethnic family and just.
Oh, no. You're Rachel Getting Married.
Rachel Getting Married. Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. Right. That's, I'm thinking of Rachel Getting Married.
I get
sorry.
Those two movies.
Oh, you were saying Noah Baumbach. I'm sorry. Yeah, Jonathan Demme. Talking about the Jonathan Demme movie that I abhorred. Because that to me, I felt like you're not even aware of how specific and weird this world is. You're basically making a movie about a girl on drugs who's going to ruin this perfect, otherwise perfect wedding. I wanted the girl on drugs to go in there with a machine gun and give them a Dogville ending and just be like, goodbye, everybody, because you're all terrible people. But I feel like in a Whit Stillman movie, he's certainly aware the whole time of his world and his audience and his characters. Mm-hmm. So I liked it a lot more than I thought I would, because I saw the trailer for it for Damsels in Distress and thought, this looks awful to me. And I thought that they were great.
Yeah, you can't sell this movie in a trailer. You can't at all,
no.
Because it's so weird. Yeah.
It's so weird, and it's really weird. And the trailer makes it look just really almost like Pleasantville or something that's right. just like where you're just like, but there were a couple things in it that I really wish had been punched up or. I hated that the newspaper was called the Daily Complainer. I thought that was so bad, like on the nose. Like, can you not come up with a better name than that? Like, there could have been such a smarter joke there than just like.
There were little throwaways that like are still making me giggle. Like when the Greta Gerwig character is talking about the history of dance crazes and she says the twist was invented by
Chubbard Checker. It was brilliant. That was hilarious.
And nobody corrects her.
No,
like,
no.
Nobody says anything.
Yeah. And the whole thing about the sidekick girl who every man who she thinks is shady, she refers to as a playboy. Operator type.
Operator type. And the plural of doofus is doofy. Yeah. And she says, you've really studied that. She goes, I've had to. And I mean, there are things in it that I thought were really great and that I enjoyed. It was just such a pleasant surprise of just like, wow, this is. And also just, I was just back in my college in the fall and just the send up of university life and how there's just so much reverence for academia, no matter what it is or where it comes from and different points of view. And I've been in LA for 12 years and I come in and I feel like, wow, I am just cynical, you know, because it's like, but like that world I love it made fun of.
And I went to UT Austin, where when I started going there, they had stopped allowing people to go to the tower because so many people were jumping off of it.
Right.
And so they finally, also during my time there, put a big fence around the edges so you could no longer do that. And so the suicide thing really made me laugh. And they're like, I think that what I after hearing you talk about why you liked it, Dave, it makes me like it more, but it also makes me realize that I think the reason I didn't really care for it was because my patience for people like this in real life is very limited.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably why for the first third of it, I was like, love it.
Absolutely.
So fun to have lunch with you.
What and a fun then, sketch. And then you want, you know.
Yeah.
And
then
for the last hour, I was like, oh my God, I so have to go home and do something really important. It's been really fun.
My final thing is like, I would rather second tier Whit Stillman than almost anybody else's A game.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. Yeah.
And now that he's back, where is Hal Hartley?
Do you hear us?
Where are our '90s auteurs? Where have they gone?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate movies like this so much more after having to sit through so many American reunions. Because anything that makes me think at all is so welcome now.
Right.
That it's, you know. And also, P.S., I really like to call the director Slim Whitman.
Slim Whitman.
That's just me.
Now, I know Gray and I saw Titanic 3D.
Yeah.
I did not see the 3D. I obviously... What is this song? I've never heard this before. I did see the movie. I saw Titanic back in 97 or whenever it came out, but I have not seen, did not see the 3D.
I saw it with Alonzo in 1997.
Yes.
I did not go with him this past Wednesday because when I saw it with him in 1997, he sobbed loudly. Like, I don't know what kind of sobbing was that like? I don't want to say.
I think the word keening might be
like actual high pitched noises involved. And so on Wednesday when he was about to leave, I said, "Do you have your cry rag? Because you're going to need it." And he came home and I said, "Well, you know, did you soak it?" And he was like, "Oh, you know, I got a little choked up."
Oh, that's awesome.
I did not bawl the way I did in 97, but I, you know, she comes in the ballroom in the end and they're all alone.
It was crazy.
I cried. And I own that. I don't care. I cried.
That's crazy.
I'm also not a Titanic apologist.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the movie, and it's because when I first saw it, it was really special to me because, like, you know, it was a holiday and my family all went together and we never see movies together. And literally, I'm riveted the entire time. And afterwards, I made everyone, like, sit through all the credits because I couldn't get up because I didn't want to lose the magic that I felt from wanting to make movies.
Wow.
That literally was the film that made me want to make movies. And I remember I went home and I called my friend and it was really late at night and I was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do with my life. And so I hang on to that emotional connection for that reason.
Sure.
And it wasn't, now I've seen it once since then and enjoyed it, didn't really pay much attention. But then I watched it again because I was going to go do like all the interviews for the premiere. And sitting on the couch, the minute that the opening credits start, I'm in tears again.
Yeah, it'll do that.
This
little Celtic flute in the background.
Oh my God, this time because I was like, oh my God, this movie changed my life. They're eating dinner and I'm in tears.
Yeah, I'm that way with Dead Poets Society. I have no gauge on if it's a good movie or not.
Yes,
because
it
sucks.
Sob. Yeah, I'm sure.
It's a crap movie.
It says the man who likes War Horse.
No, but I saw that movie at a time where, that's what I'm saying. I can't vouch for it as a good movie, but I hear that music. I hear that bagpipes and that music from that movie, and I will. And it's so manipulative. It's the same as Matthew McConaughey's speech in A Time to Kill, where it makes me bawl. And I'm like, this is terrible writing. This is horrible. But I am so like a mess in that.
The Color Purple.
Sure.
They take that first baby away, and I'm already off to the races.
Any scene from A Color Purple. I mean, the Lord's trying to tell you something, and that comes on. You're like, good night, everyone. Yeah. I'm done.
I would like to take a big dump on all of your opinions, but I can't because
War Horse.
Because I got all choked up at War Horse.
Right, you did.
Well, because the horse comes back at the end, and their boy likes the horse so much, and they're happy. And then I also cried at Warrior last year.
I didn't see either of those.
I was super choked up and really crying at the end of Warrior.
Shockingly and good.
It's fun to make fun of Alonzo at any moment for any reason.
Well,
but I know where movie, it's coming from.
Different movie. I did the same.
Yeah.
Well, no, I have a question, Alonzo. Did you watch it coming from a different perspective, like a 15-year plus perspective this time?
Yeah, kind of. Because I think I saw it maybe once or twice when it came out, and I know I owned the clamshell VHS packaging.
Yes,
that came out, but I don't remember that I ever actually sat and watched it on TV. But yeah, it's kind of easy to think in retrospect, Titanic. It was because it became such a thing, and that song and all that stuff, and you know, like whatever. But I have to admit, it's really engrossing. I mean, there are you do notice the things that are wrong with it, and there are things that are wrong with it. Billy Zane.
He's never wrong. He's wonderful. He's beautiful. He's incredible.
You know, Danny Nucci.
He yelled at me. I'm over him.
He did? Oh, God. I had a great experience with him working with him.
You lucky bastard.
And I love him. I just think he's fantastic.
But, like, you know, Danny Nucci doing that, like, Super Mario Brothers performance. Like, God, that is niente. You know, like, so hammy and bad.
You gotta unlock the door.
And Francis Fisher. I mean, like, there's some stuff that doesn't work. But... And there's some dialogue that's clunky, but like the Winslet and DiCaprio so commit to that love story and really make that thing work. The Gloria Stewart's performance is so great. Yeah. I had forgotten how great she was in that. And then it was also like with any, when you go and see any movie from 15 years ago, like when you start noticing the bit players who are now famous,
right?
Like the guy who was on the lifeboat going, "Is anyone alive out there?" Is Mr. Yon. Is Yoan Griffith from the Fantastic Four?
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And like I, you know, the guy, one of the guys from the British Queer as Folk, like had three lines.
Wow. You had a great tweet about this though. That Titanic is even. Go ahead.
I said Titanic is even sadder now because we know the heir to Downton Abbey was on board.
Oh, I saw that. I saw that. Yeah.
And, well, and I found that this time around that it wasn't even so much the love story that got me as it was everything else. So it was like at the end, the people that knew that they weren't going to escape. Mm. And, you know, just little things like just all those people had no idea what was coming and what was going to hit them. And the band got me way more this time. I just thought that different parts of it were even more touching now that I'm 15 years old.
I think it really captures, like, because it was a boat that sailed once, you know, and most of the people who were on it died. Like, we'll never know what it was like. But I think Cameron really goes out of his way to capture what that experience was like from the luxury of first class and having your own personal veranda and the plates and the silver and the you know, down to, like, the bunk beds and steerage. And then the actual sinking. I mean, like, that sinking is like half the movie, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's a long time, and he really, he does a lot of clever things to sort of set up what's going to happen later, like the guy doing the computer simulation of the sinking, or, you know, clown Jesus Victor Garber telling her about how there aren't enough lifeboats, you know? And so when it's all happening, you're like, oh, this is, oh, and this is, like, you know what's happening, so you can focus on all the...
Right.
On the emotional stuff and on the kind of the action movie stuff. Right. Like, you know, I always say that in action movies, one of the key things is you always have to know where everybody is in relation to everybody else. And so you know exactly, okay, they're down here in the hold, and Billy Zane's up on the deck with a gun, and the butler guy's over here, and da-da-da, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's a really effective sequence.
And you know what, also another thing that got me this time that I don't even remember even noticing was when Gloria Stewart goes, you know, "It was the first time she'd ever sailed. No one had ever slept in the sheets." And I went, ooh.
You're like, I am 15 years older than I was before. Ooh, sheets.
I also loved how, like, how douchey Bill Paxton was. Like that
with
really,
his earring and a bad dye job.
Oh my god! And just like,
I don't even I remember that he was in the device that he's like he bookends the movie, but I don't remember him at all really in the
I didn't either really. And even when I say to people like, "Oh, I talked to Bill Paxton for this," they were like, "He's in it?" Because people don't even remember.
He's the guy that says, "Are you ready to go back to Titanic?"
Right. Yeah. And then so I had asked him. I was like, "So you and James Cameron are like best friends, and." Like, what was it like to actually play him in this movie? Because you kind of do totally play him. He's like, he's like, "You're totally right." And he came up with this douchey name, Brock Lovett, and I played him like a douche. What does that say?
That's awesome.
And speaking of, like, the James Cameron repertory company, I love that Jeanette Goldstein plays an Irish immigrant.
And who was Jeanette Goldstein?
For Aliens, she's the...
She's great.
Yeah, and she's in Terminator 2. And
she
pops
awesome.
Up as this Irish immigrant and gets the brogue and does the whole
thing. Oh, how funny. I remember really, really enjoying Titanic when I saw it and not really, you know, not jumping on the bandwagon to bag it. Not loving it. And I watched it once in the theater and thought it was really entertaining and incredibly well shot and... It was one of those. I was like, good, saw it, moving on. Like, I didn't, but.
Yeah, there was a big backlash, certainly by the time of the Oscars when, you know, Cameron says, "I'm king of the world." And people were like, ugh.
They were over
I always thought was unfair, by the way. I always thought that was crappy that people gave him so much stuff.
People
over
do that, though. I mean, I feel like it's important to see things early and with them, because people do have that thing where they decide. A lot of times it happens to the Best Picture movie because it's like, by the time the Oscars finally roll around in March, you're so over hearing about this movie, especially if you're, you know, anywhere in the, you know, entertainment world, and so you end up hating that movie for
sight
reasons
unseen,
that have nothing to do
with
the movie.
I think people's problem now is that most of them don't even get to see the Best Picture nominees because they were released in New York and LA for a week.
Right.
And so they were like, "The Artist? What's The Artist?" Which is just it's the 2012 version of I Hate That Movie.
I will say Cameron kind of brought on himself. He rather legendarily got into this feud with Kenneth Turan at the LA Times. for not liking Titanic. And it was, literally, there was this like back and forth going on in the paper. And it was like, really, Cameron?
Yeah,
like,
do you have other things?
Calm down, you know?
May I quote him? You're going to have to beat me if I quote him.
Go for
Can
it.
Can I?
Please.
He was talking about how he didn't want to change any of the effects. George Lucas, screw you. And then he pauses, and I thought he was done with his answer, but then he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, and by the way, it won Best Picture, so don't f*** with perfection." And I was like, there he is. There's that
That's
guy.
That's our Cameron.
That's the one I wanted.
Just like Crash and the, you know,
the greatest show on earth.
And yeah, exactly. Just like perfect films always win Best Picture. And other that means it was literally the best picture of the year.
And I loved how satisfied he was when he said it. Oh, it was great.
He like folded his arms over his chest.
He did, and he smiled. He smirked. Oh. He didn't. He was great. Oh. I loved it. Hey, because you know what? If you're going to be a filmmaker and act like that, you got to be James Cameron.
Right.
So
right.
It's like,
right.
Okay, bro, do what you want, because you're you.
I would like to take this opportunity to recommend a book to our listeners.
Weird.
The name of this book is Let's Talk About Love.
Oh, yes.
A Journey to the End of Taste. It's about Celine Dion.
Oh.
What?
It is a part of a series of books put out under, it's a series called 33 and a Third. And each book
is about
a different album or a performer. And, oh, I'm sorry. Let me take straight
They're
that
all
back.
About an album.
They're all about an album. Sorry. This book is about Celine Dion's Let's Talk About Love. The album that has
My Heart Will Go On
in it. And unlike almost all the other books in this series, where the theme of the book is, here's something about this really great record.
Mm-hmm.
The author of this book takes her album with this song on it, and it's, you know, ubiquity, and uses it as a method for exploring what's wrong with mass taste.
Wow.
In everything. And by the end of it, he kind of comes to enjoy Celine Dion.
Wow.
And I mean, the book is about the idea of, like, why do we like what we like? Mm-hmm. Why are certain things considered cool and other things are considered uncool? You know, where does taste come from, and where,
sure,
you know,
yeah.
And yeah, basically using Celine Dion and this album as a jumping off point, and it's fascinating. And whatever you feel about Celine Dion, like the book really has interesting things to say about just the idea of the mass taste and the culture, you know, as we think about it.
Sure, I love that.
And the first chapter is about the Oscars of that year and how she came out and sang My Heart Will Go On, and then Elliott Smith came out and sang that little sad little song from
Miss Misery.
Good Will Hunting, Miss Misery.
Oh, yeah.
And how snotty Madonna was when presenting the Best Song Award, because she was super into Elliott Smith to win, and you could feel it and you could tell it just from the way she was talking and everything. And then when Celine Dion won the Oscar for the song, or whoever wrote the song, whatever, Madonna opens the envelope and goes, "Of course."
Oh,
and,
oh, wow.
And then says the name. So this is all in the book, and it's all about how Elliott Smith reacted to everything.
Hmm.
And what he said to the press afterwards was, he goes, "Celine Dion couldn't have been nicer and kinder and sweeter to me. And she could tell that I was freaking out about just even being there. And she was as graceful and decent and kind." And it was like, you get the sense that there's nothing fake about Celine Dion in the book. I mean, you associate her with the biggest, mm-hmm, worst song ever,
sure,
you know,
sure,
that everyone loves somehow and also kind of hates. And especially that version. Do y'all remember the version on the pop radio stations that had vocal
dialogue
from
the movie
edited in to the song?
Oh, boy.
Did y'all ever hear that? You could probably find it on YouTube if you went and looked for it.
The best.
But this whole idea that, like, there's actually nothing fake about this person that is in a world where, you know, that kind of fakeness is prized and valued and loved by the people who love it. And so it's a really interesting book, and it's tangentially about this movie.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
There are also a lot of great, like, YouTube videos of Celine Dion and her show. Like, where she just...
Oh, yeah.
And that's where
Documentary. Did you see that documentary?
Yeah, I was going to say, in addition to reading Let's Talk About Love, you have to see her concert movie documentary.
I think I get that she's not a fake person, because after just watching those things, she's just crazy.
She's a goofus, and she'll do it, and she'll be a goofus on camera. Like, I have her music is not anything that I don't own any of her stuff. I don't particularly like any of her stuff, but I love her now that I've seen this concert film.
Need to investigate, because I've written off anything.
Well, we were fascinated. We had both just finished reading that book when her concert documentary came out, and I was like, let's go see this movie. Mm-hmm. Let's complete the package, and let's go see this movie. So we went to the Grove, and we saw it, and there was like three other people the theater, and they were like three gays who were totally Celine fans. And sat in the back, and we were like, this is crazy. This movie's nuts. And
I have to know.
It's fascinating. What's it called? What's the name of the movie?
Celine Dion is French. I need your
face. Celine Dion will go on.
Colon something.
For all the adults, for all the parents, and all the children in the world.
That would be everyone. And it's funny, because if you saw the Justin Bieber documentary, where at the at the end of the movie, he's like, oh, is he going to lose his voice? He has to go to the expert in New York, and they shove the camera down his throat, and you see his larynx or whatever. They totally stole that plot beat from the Celine Dion movie, because the exact same thing happens. Wow. She's going to play Madison Square Garden. Her voice is shot from going around the world. She goes to, like, the world's greatest ENT guy. They shove the camera down her throat. Mm. You know, so, yeah, that's Bieber totally
stole
that.
You get to see her uvula.
Oh. Yeah, you do.
Yes.
All right. Sadly, though, Celine Dion did not have a 3D slow motion hair shake in her film.
Give her time.
I just want to see one of those movies where they do lose their voice, and it's just like, there's no hope. Yeah, like, I want to see one of those where it's like,
and the show's canceled.
Yeah.
Sorry, fans.
Sorry, guys. Yeah. It really happened. They really can't sing their final concert over their documentary. Like, you know.
Darn you, science.
I know. I know, I want to see that.
Also this week, a new film from Guy Maddin, the kooky Canadian auteur, called Keyhole.
Yeah, because I don't think it's opened in Los Angeles.
No, it opened in New York. It opens in L.A. This coming Friday.
It opened in New York and on Dave and Alonzo's television for me.
Yeah. we got sent a screener. Now, I read your review online. You were not a fan.
I feel like this movie is for English lit majors. And I'm fine with that, because once again, as I said earlier, any movie that makes me think like I'm a fan of immediately on that level.
Right.
And this movie definitely does that, because I understand throughout the film that I couldn't give you a plot summary of if I tried.
It's a Guy Maddin also, so it's
Be
hard.
And it's like, I get that there's a lot of imagery and there's a lot of references and you have to be smart and read stuff, and I get that. And I guess I'm not one of those people.
Wait, you want to be entertained?
Amazingly. Oh, okay. And it's like, if I see Jason Patrick carrying around a Wolverine, I guess I'm expecting a lot more than him just eventually putting it down and then yelling at ghost Isabella Rossellini.
Oh,
I don't know.
Boy.
Which is like, this movie felt like every parody of an independent film I've ever seen.
I will grant you, there is a reading of this that's not unlike, have you ever seen Deduva?
No.
It was a short film from the 60s. It was like an Ingmar Bergman parody. Madeline Kahn is in it. It's on YouTube, and it's very much like, it's in black and white, and people at the seashore being all angsty, you know? And yeah, I mean, I think Guy Maddin is so sort of unironically weird that you could sort of read the whole thing as self-parody. But I mean, like, I remember one time in Dallas when I was running the USA Film Festival, we screened, Dave was there for this, we screened Twilight of the Ice Nymphs, and Shelley Duvall is in it, and she lived in Texas, and she would come up for stuff, so she came up for the screening. And then afterwards, somebody got very angry and was like, was he on drugs when he made this? And she's like, no, like, this is how he sees the world. And like, the guy like kept confronting her and was like, really, like, you know, that sort of, you know, Rube was mad about this artist is trying to pull one over on him. And she was basically like, he's a poet. You know, this is what he does. This is what he makes. This is how he perceives, you know, the world around him. And bam.
Poor Shelley Duvall has had men yelling at her all of her life. She cannot get away from just people screaming at her and just charging her with all the problems of the world.
As of 1998, however, she was still not broken by it because she came up for the screening. And I was there early because I was, you know, with the boss. And she was there early, and she came in with her mom, and she had a big bucket of popcorn. And she goes, she says to me, "Would you like some of my popcorn?" I was like, "Shelley Duvall is offering me popcorn." And I said, "Yes." Uh-huh. And so yeah, we had popcorn together. Oh, it was awesome. Really good.
You have such a cool life.
I don't have a filter for Guy Madden. Like, and by that, that might not even be the right thing that I'm trying to say. I don't have a way of judging whether or not he has made a good movie or a bad movie because I love him so much that he could turn in a piece of self-indulgent crap and I'd be like, it's a new Guy Madden movie. I'm so happy. Like, from the time in the 90s when I saw his first movie, or the first feature, right, it was Tales from Gimli Hospital. I was like, I don't know who you are, mister, but you're freaky. And what's that song? I think you're freaky, and I like you a lot. From that moment, I just knew that this was one of my dudes. Like, I was going to follow him forever. And so watching, you know, Keyhole, and then watching it again with Alonzo, I just, you know, everything... As swirly and weird and alinear and just nuts as it is, and oh look, here's all these keyholes that people are looking through, and here's all things shot with bullet holes, and oh, and here's a glory hole, and it's got a dusty penis sticking out of it
that twitches.
Jason Patrick walks past it and says, "That penis is getting dusty," and that's what happens in the movie. Yeah. It's sort of a neglected erection that nobody is bothered to dust or pay any attention to at all. And it's just there. Yeah. And I, when I see that, it just reminds me of other films that he has made, like Cowards Bend the Knee and other, like,
I love his Dracula. What's his Dracula ballet?
Dracula's Diary.
Which is beautiful. Yeah. I loved that.
I love everything he does. I think
what's the short that he did that's so great? Is it Heart of the World?
Heart of the World.
Heart of the World.
Heart of the World is on YouTube. You should totally watch it.
Yeah, I should check it out. He's intrigued me because, I mean, I've seen the other one with the...
Saddest Music in the World, yes, which I also think is fantastic with Isabella Rossellini. With the legs made of glass and filled with beer. And so I just, you know, everything about him sets my pleasure centers sort of on fire. Like, I'm happy, happy, happy when I'm watching his movies. I don't care what they're about. I just can't stop looking at them and enjoying them.
You can't care. And that's the thing that I didn't really... I didn't really, like... I don't really remember Saddest Music in the World enough to compare the two together. Mm-hmm. But in watching this, you have to just be along for the ride.
But, and Saddest Music actually had a fairly...
It was pretty coherent.
Yeah, like it has a narrative, it has a through line, and there's a thing that is happening, and there are people who are competing, and there are, you know, the characters have goals, blah, 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 and this is not that.
No. And you can't... And the thing is that I didn't find... I wasn't upset by it, and I didn't dislike it, and I saw that... I was excited by, like, the art of it, because it really was aesthetically interesting, and every single moment I was like, what is going on now? This is crazy. But did I understand what it was about? No. Is it even really going to stay with me past just imagery? Right. And the answer is no.
Well, you know.
It's a very ghosty haunted house. It's a very ghosty haunted house hallucination based The Odyssey.
Right. Yeah, of course.
I mean, that's for anybody who wants to know what the actual plot is, the guy, Jason Patrick, plays a gangster.
Named Ulysses.
Named Ulysses, okay. Who gets stuck in his old house, and he has to make his way through the house looking for his wife, Hyacinth, played by Isabella Rossellini. And so he has to go past all these, like, ghosts and rooms and things that are doors that are locked. And, you know, there's a furnace full of exploding guns, and there's a bicycle-powered electric chair that he gets strapped into. He's got his own tied-up, bound-and-gagged son along with him, but he doesn't recognize his son. Isabella Rossellini's upstairs on a bed. There's a naked old man who's a ghost chained to the bed.
Her father,
and he's the one saying, like, Ulysses, do not trust your eyes. You know, and you're like, Well, yeah, because he's...
Remember your disease.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what it's about.
Right.
But it's also about just a lot of crazy, you know, it's a movie about movies and it's a dream about dreams and it's, you know, weird.
Yeah, like there are movies where you're like, okay, event, like I'm going to piece these clues together, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. at the end I'm going to know. And then this one, I'd say by the end of the first act, I was like, this is not going anywhere in terms of like, this is not a puzzle yeah. box that I'm going to solve. Like it's yeah. just.
I have to be in a mood to, and I have to kind of know that going into this because for me, it's all about where I am, because those are the kind of movies that if I'm sitting down to enjoy like a really crazy, interesting meal that I don't really care what's happening next, I'm going to be way into it. If like I have somewhere to be and I'm, you know, and I'm thinking and I get in my head and I start thinking about something, I really, when I give up on a movie because I've tried too hard, it's made me work too much, then I'm just like, I feel dumb and annoyed and I paid $12 for, you know,
right. You have to kind of know what you're in for. But like, I always think there's a great quote from Peter Greenaway where he says that like the cinema is too rich a medium to be left to the storytellers. So I like the idea that every so often I can see a movie where like, okay, this is not about the story. I don't need to be thinking.
Sure.
I don't have to have that hat on. So I'm just going to, I'm going to walk through this like it's a video installation or like it's an exhibition at a museum or whatever, and just look at it and maybe I'll know what is going on and maybe I won't, well, but I'll just sort of take it in. You know.
I argue there's several movies like that are wildly different in tone, but like a Robert Altman movie at his best is sort of in a similar thing where there is no real story. There's no, it's people. It's you're dropping in on people, which I love. And that's my favorite. It's just feeling like I'm getting characters at me, like that where I'm just like, what is that person's story? I'm getting two lines from that person, and that's so interesting to me. And to me, that's all. I think that's such interesting, and it leaves it up to me as a viewer to sort of figure out what I think.
Yeah, I feel the same way about him that I feel about Apichat Pongwara's Ethical, because he, and he has said in interviews where people are like, "How come your movies don't make any sense? How come you don't tell stories the way people tell stories?" And he's like, "Why should I tell stories the way people tell stories? How come I can't tell stories some other way, my own way? If you can't figure it out, you know, then watch it again." Like, yeah, I don't get angry
about if you don't figure it out, and maybe because I think that, you know, we're in such a—it's really creepy to me when people need to get things.
Right.
When they go, "I don't get it." And
right.
They,
right.
Unlike.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, sort of like, how about you just experience it and you don't feel like you have to solve it? Like, the answer is, it's the old thing of like, the answer is less interesting than the question. It's like, have the questions and I'm so fine not getting things and just enjoying an experience.
Yeah.
Ironically, although my name would suggest otherwise, I do mostly like for things to be black or white. And the thing that I'm noticing though as we're having this conversation is I think that as time goes on, I'm maybe have to focus on meditating a little bit more because I get impatient.
I could be the same way.
And that's part of what happens to me now is like I don't know if it's my iPad or my cell phone that's to blame, but it's like after about 30 or 45 minutes, then I start going like, oh my God, there's so many things I could be doing other than this.
Yeah, I was that way with In Melancholia, which I think is a brilliant, beautiful movie. Like
I
liked that,
one,
at all. But I got so like, I get it, we get it. Moving on. Let's move on. Okay, thank you. Let's end the world now.
Right.
Let's move on. You know, and it's like, because I think that
collide already.
Will you end the world so I can go home?
Exactly. I'm like, there's gonna be so much traffic on 405. Like I'm just thinking about what's happening. I'm like watching this masterpiece and just only thinking about
it. Well, there's a quote from, you know, Yodorovsky, the guy that made El Topo.
Oh, God,
Golden Mountain.
The Holy Mountain.
Mountain.
It sounds like the kind of thing that maybe James Cameron would say, where he actually said, like if you are great, my films are great. And if you are lacking, my films are lacking.
Oh, yes. Well, I must be great because I love his movies. They're so insane and they're so much fun to watch.
Even just the trailers for his movies make me go, woohoo!
I know. I'm so happy.
I'm embarrassed to say I've never seen any of Yodorovsky's films. He's one of my big.
I know.
He's one of the big holes in my film education. But and another one I'm about to be filling in because the Cine Family is about to do a whole series of Bélatar movies.
Yes.
This Hungarian filmmaker who makes these long, slow, you know, art, capital A art films.
punishment.
Yeah, which I've never seen any of them.
Punishment?
Yeah.
That's so hot. Delicately into the
but
the downloads for this episode are going to be huge.
I'm going to start catching up on him, which I'm very excited about. But to as a balance, I did go see Hudson Hawk in 35mm
yes.
at the New Beverly, and it was great.
I love that. I will totally defend Hudson Hawk. It's so much fun. It's so much fun.
I had a blast, I reread. There's a great book that Richard E. Grant did called With Nails, and it's his diaries from working on these different movies. And like Hudson Hawk was a cluster F of universal proportions. Like,
sure.
Just nobody knew what was going on, and suddenly it was like there was a whole heist that they were going to shoot at the Louvre that they didn't, and there was going to be the ending was going to be this chase through the Kremlin, and they were going to shoot it in Hungary, but then they cut it out, but then they wound up going to Hungary anyway to shoot all the interiors for the Italian scenes, even though they were in Italy, and all this just bananas kind of stuff. And then he sees the movie and is just horrified by the result. But I think it's a lot of fun.
I mean, Sandra Bernhardt and Gold, I mean, that alone. Them singing with exploding guns. I'm just like, come on. There are so many worse movies. People love to batch that in with, like, Ishtar and, like, the worst movies I've ever been like, come on, Hudson Hawk is not. Yeah. It's nothing, but it's fascinating.
Yeah.
You can't turn away.
Annie McDowell speaks dolphin, you know.
Oh, I wish she always would. I would, that would be such a wonderful universe.
We got to wrap it up.
Yeah, we have come to the end of another episode. I'm never going to do DVD recommendations because we've talked about enough other old movies this episode. And I'm not even going to run through the list of podcasts except to say, of course, Grey Drake, Popcorn Mafia, always a show you need to be checking out. And we thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Drew, it was such a treat to have you.
Thank you. What a treat to be on here.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for
having me.
We
so appreciate it. And we have great emails that we need to share, but
we'll get to them.
We'll save them next time. There's a lovely one from Canada, somebody who said that they checked out the clock because of us, which I was very excited.
Oh, good.
Oh, nice.
And the thing is, she was pregnant at the time. Wow. She talked about how for the first hour she had to sit on the floor, and then finally somebody gave her a chair. And I'm like, it took an hour for somebody to give a pregnant woman
a
chair?
What kind of monsters are those Canadians?
In Canada. Like, I thought you guys were all polite. My mind is blown. Anyway, we'll read letters next week.
Must have been Vancouver.
I guess. But Montreal, if you know what I'm saying. Anyway, if you would like to drop us a line, we would love to hear from you. We are at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
And we really will answer the letters.
We will, we promise. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow, like our Facebook page, Linoleum Podcast, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Follow us on Twitter @linoleumcast. And you can check into the show on Get Glue. Even though we're listed under TV for whatever reason. Where can folks find you guys on? Your Gray is Popcorn Mafia on Twitter.
Yes, correct? I'm Popcorn Mafia on Twitter and popcornmafia.com. And then you can read my reviews with Dave on movies.com.
That's right.
Hooray!
And Drew, where can
people? And you can, my podcast is on hiatus, but you can always follow me on Twitter, which is @DrewDrogi. And
spell that.
Spell your last name.
Yeah.
DrewDroege. Love I feel like that. I'm on the phone with Bank of America. So you can follow me on Twitter. And when the podcast comes back, because it will, I will certainly let you know. So.
And you have, are you currently doing Hard Choices in Los Angeles?
Strong Choices.
Strong Choices, sorry.
Next weekend, yes, at Casita del Campo. If you're in LA, the lovely and talented Sam Pancake will be joining me for a ridiculous hour of insane life coachery called Strong Choices. And it's at the Casita del Campo Cavern Club Theater. Friday and Saturday. At 8 and 10 p.m.
And that's the 13th and 14th of April?
13th and 14th of April, yes.
Excellent.
Please come.
If you're
totally worth going to because you guys are both so funny that you supersede the idea of wanting to kill yourself when you're down in that theater. I hate that theater so much. It's cramped. It's underground. It's tiny. It's like the seats are 5 inches across. There's no room for.
Clearly,
a
you hate margaritas.
I hate margaritas.
That's what this boils down to.
It's like a claustrophobia test room,
which is exactly a perfect place for our show because we are these horrible. life coaches, and you do feel trapped when you're in the business. And we play up on that. We're very aware of that.
I love it because it makes me understand what it must be like to be in a Mexican womb.
Well, my dream board needs work, so life coaching is right up my alley. Thank you guys so much for coming.
You.
This was a treat. We thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.